Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of May 30th, 2014. This week, millennials get a bad rap for being all about me, but they could end up less narcissistic than their parents. What job hunting during a recession can do to your psyche. Also, how to weed out the scams when consolidating your debt. And, of course, we'll be taking your money questions. But first, Google said this week that its new driverless car can probably drive better than you can. But I think we'd all drive pretty excellently if we also only went 25 miles per hour. So are we ready to relinquish the wheel? Ben Johnson, the host of Marketplace Tech, is here to muse about this. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Barbara.
Okay, Google's been working on this driverless car project for a while now. What's new about this car other than the lack of a steering wheel or brake pedals, as if that wasn't enough newness?
Well, certainly, as you note, it's now missing some of the sort of human controls that have been in the other Google self-driving cars. Admittedly, they were being operated by machinery. This car is also kind of like almost not a car, right? You look at it, it doesn't really look like their old cars, which were Priuses. It looks like this sort of like round, you know, fuzzy pod-shaped thing that you get into, and it doesn't really have a driver's seat. It doesn't have steering wheel, et cetera, et cetera. And it goes relatively slowly, and it's more just like this pod that takes you from one place to the next, which I think is really interesting because it suggests that Google's maybe trying to change the way we think about the self-driving car.
Well, if anyone did have confidence in software over humans, it would be Google, right? But are consumers at all ready to get into a self-guided car like this? I mean, I don't even use cruise control. I'm that paranoid about the imminent robot invasion.
This is a really interesting question. And I think, you know, we could look at this new self-driving car prototype and actually make some comparisons to one of Google's other sort of famous recent inventions, right, which is Google Glass. And in a way, both of these things suggest a future that I think we're not quite ready for yet. Now, Google says that it's going to build a couple hundred of these. They're going to be testing them in Northern California. And, you know, they only go 25 miles per hour. So this is, you know, it's an incremental step, I suppose, in terms of their plan for world domination of self-driving cars. I don't think consumers, not at least in America, are necessarily ready to hop into these things. I think we're all a little bit nervous about it. Now, some of the futurists I've talked to and other people who are real proponents of this sort of thing say that, you know, we need to get used to it because in the real world that we live in now, thousands of people die every year because of human error, because of people being drunk on the road, because of all sorts of things that kill people all the time, and that potentially self-driving cars would actually save a lot of lives on the road.
Well, sure, and it would be a brave new world if these cars really were safer alternatives. So what is Google envisioning beyond no designated drivers needed?
I think it's hard to tell what Google itself is envisioning, but I will say this, right? When you're in a car that no longer has a driver and isn't designed to have a driver, it's probably a lot easier for you to, I don't know, be on a computer of some sort and be watching television maybe, or being served online ads while you surf the net, or lots of other things like that. And as we all know, Google makes most of its money from selling advertising online. So I think
exactly.
Yeah, we can probably guess at something there. There's another idea here, which is that this could be a really disruptive force to our economy in a good way, according to some. Imagine a world, Barbara, where you order a pair of shoes on Zappos and a couple hours later, a car shows up to your house and, you know, doesn't have any driver in it or any human in it, but it has your pair of shoes in it. And you pull the pair of shoes out and you try them on and they don't fit. So you throw them back in the car and you say, back to whence you came, and your sort of e-commerce life becomes a lot easier there.
Right. You've both hit my dream and my nightmare, right, in one handy image. Didn't I just mention imminent robot invasion?
Yes, that's right. It is a little bit scary. But also, you know, people talk about making cities a lot more efficient, putting less pollutants into the air, freeing up a lot of parking lot real estate, although I'm sure some of the powerful parking lot interests in New York City would not be happy about this sort of thing necessarily.
Well, I can't wait to hear more, and I'm sure we will hear more about driverless cars on Marketplace Tech. Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thank you kindly for this.
Thank you, Barbara.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. It seems that every generation thinks they're better than the next, right? And this, hey, you kids get off my lawn attitude has been particularly tough on millennials. They've been called entitled, lazy, self-involved. But these are also young people who came of age during a recession. And new research indicates that makes you less narcissistic. Emily Bianchi co-authored the study. She's an assistant professor at Emory University's Guazzetta School of Business. Hi, Emily. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And so your research found that the economy affected how narcissistic people are and that they're less narcissistic when they've come of age in a recession or in tougher economic times. So what are the hallmarks of narcissism? How did you gauge them?
Hallmarks of narcissism are, you know, lack of empathy, a sense that one is better than other people around them, a kind of a heightened sense of self-importance, even a willingness to exploit other people to achieve one's own gains. And there's been a large body of research in social psychology suggesting, as well as clinical psychology, suggesting that, you know, narcissism has very important implications for both behavior at work and for people's interpersonal relationships.
How does narcissism manifest itself in the workplace?
In the workplace, it can kind of be viewed as a double-edged sword. On the one hand, narcissists tend to be very charming. People tend to be drawn to them. They tend to be very charismatic. They tend to be inspiring leaders. On the other hand, they tend to be very difficult to work for. They tend to take credit for anything that goes well and tend to assign blame for anything that goes poorly. They don't tend to make terrific mentors, and people often feel sort of out on their own when they are working for a narcissist.
How do tough economic times then dampen those tendencies, those narcissistic tendencies?
You know, we don't know a whole lot about where narcissism comes from, but what we do know seems to suggest that narcissism is tempered by adversity and, to some extent, by failure. Children now aren't allowed to kind of experience failure in the same way that used to be permitted. And the idea here is that, you know, narcissism is cultivated by, you know, allowing egos to expand unchecked by adversity and by humbling setbacks or failures. To the extent that that's true, there's no question that coming of age and first looking for a job poses a substantial amount of adversity. We've all heard stories over the last few years of people who have earned college degrees and were forced to move back home with their parents because they couldn't support themselves financially.
Well, I'm thinking this isn't all that surprising, right? It seems to make sense that if you suffer a bit, it makes you more empathetic than, say, the kids who were born or who came of age during the 80s and 90s, the boom years. Are you surprised?
Yes and no. I certainly it is in line with this idea that adversity kind of promotes empathy and promotes an understanding that maybe one isn't as important or special as one might have thought. On the other hand, the narrative seems to still be that this is, you know, the most narcissistic generation in history. And so it doesn't seem to reflect the fact that, you know, they've been through a tremendously humbling several years.
So let's assume your findings are right. What does this say about this millennial generation and their future behavior in the workplace? Are we going to have fewer charismatic leaders but more empathetic ones?
Perhaps. You know, I mean, time will tell how this emerges with the millennial generation, but I think it does point to a potential silver lining in what is otherwise clearly a very dark cloud, right? So we know that their careers have been affected or likely to be affected in all sorts of negative ways. But I think most people would probably be pleased to hear that this might temper narcissism in the workplace.
Well, why do you think millennials get such a bad rap? Because in my experience, I've worked with all different kinds of people from this generation, and it's a huge generation. It's very diverse.
So I think there are a couple of reasons. First, this belief preceded the Great Recession. So a very famous and widely cited meta-analysis on narcissism came out in early 2008 before the economy really tanked and showed that narcissism had increased since the early 1980s. And to some extent, people, older adults have always thought of younger adults as sort of self-absorbed brutes, if you will. For instance, Socrates said, children today are tyrants. They contradict their parents, gobble their food, and tyrannize their teachers.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, the older generation always resents the youth of the younger one.
It is. So I think that's part of this story. And I also think, and one thing, there's a lot of debate around narcissism and whether it hasn't increased. But I think one thing that most social psychologists agree on is that narcissism decreases with age. And one reason is because young adulthood is by design, or maybe not by design, but how it works out, is a very self-absorbed phase of life, because this is a time when people, you know, are leaving their families of origin, are trying to determine who they're going to be personally or professionally. They are yet to have, in most cases, their own families and to be responsible for caring for children and being part of, you know, an adult in a family unit. So it, in some sense, it's not surprising that people are more self-absorbed at this stage of life than they tend to be later.
Emily Bianchi is a professor at Emory University's Goizueta Business School. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, would you marry someone carrying a load of credit card debt? Our personal finance expert weighs in. And it's so easy to get shopping so wrong.
If you want the best deals, you know, with the most inventory, you're often best off shopping for groceries on Wednesday. But of course, people feel like they don't have time, so they do it on a Saturday.
Consumer reporter with MarketWatch, Katie Hill, plans your bargain hunting schedule. That's later on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Barbara Bogave. It's time now to take your calls about money. Personal finance expert Lauren Lyons-Cole is here with some much-appreciated, level-headed advice. Welcome back, Lauren.
Thanks, Barbara.
Well, before we get to the calls, I have a seasonal question for you. It's almost June, the traditional time for weddings. And also with same-sex marriage bans being struck down in so many states, people are just rushing to the altar.
Right.
So what money issues should every couple at least start to hash out before they take their vows?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me about how to save money on all the weddings people are going to be attending this summer.
I could have gone that route, I'm going more touchy-feely.
Yeah. I always say that the couples who learn how to talk about money can talk about anything. It is the hardest topic for so many people. And so just having open conversations, no judgment, because, you know, we've all learned growing up different things from our parents. And it really takes years to try to unpack those things and then to understand how this creature who's next to you has their own things, how you combine. So I think just really talking about money from an open, non-judgmental place is the best thing a couple can do.
Oh, now that's really helpful, and especially given that at least one of our calls today is, I think, as much about relationships as it is about money. Mm-hmm. So, Lauren, are you ready to take some calls?
I am ready. Let's do it.
Great. First up is Vivian in my hometown of Philadelphia. Hi, Vivian.
Hi.
So, welcome. And are the dogwoods and azalea all abloom there?
Absolutely.
I miss it so much. What do you do in Philly to earn money?
I work at a higher education institution.
Okay. And how much do you make?
I make a little bit over $45,000, so 46.
Okay, great. I like to get the most direct and impolite question out of the way right away.
Perfect.
So what is your question for us today?
So I wanted to talk a little bit about a relationship question. I'm in a relationship with somebody who is not very good at managing money and hasn't been very good at managing money. We've been together now for a little bit over 5 years, and he comes to this relationship bearing about 20 grand in debt. And I'm talking about completely consumer debt. He does not have a college degree, and he works as a manager at a retail store. So he makes probably about $35,000 a year.
And I see here in my notes that he works in a bookstore chain, which is not a sector, sadly, long for this world.
Indeed.
So what are his long-term career plans?
So that's sort of the mix of questions that I was hoping to get at today with you guys. He's recently enrolled in a local university in Delaware, and I just kind of wanted to get the sense from you, is that even a smart idea right now at this point with having so much consumer debt? He does have goals to be a professional, working in marketing and communications, and potentially even go on to graduate school, but right now he's just really buried in a ton of consumer debt that hasn't really bared anything for him over his life.
Well, okay, I'm going to turn you over to Lauren, but just one question. How about you? What do your finances look like?
So I have zero debt. I have no college debt. I do have an undergraduate degree, and because I work at an institution for higher education, I'm actually getting my master's degree right now for free.
Okay, Lauren, I'm thinking sometimes individuals and a couple balance each other out, but sometimes it tears them apart. So where do we start here?
Here's the thing, is I do think that spenders and savers are attracted to each other, and a lot of times that's good because you can balance each other out, but there are times where one person can drag the other person down, and I'm not setting up to say that that's what's happening here, but I think that the $20,000 in consumer debt, Vivian, as you're rightfully pointing out, is a lot. I mean, the average American family has $15,000 in credit card debt, so this is not even a family situation. This is a single person who's racked up that much. And I'm not really as concerned about the debt as I am concerned about what's behind the debt. So the spending decisions that were made to get to that point, they can be changed. But I think it's really important not just to tackle the debt, but also to tackle the spending choices, because sometimes that's the harder part.
Yeah, and to jump onto that, Vivian, what kinds of conversations have you had about his debt and his career and your future, and how do you feel about those conversations?
It's really hard for me to answer this question because I'm very close to it, and we've been together for a significant amount of time, and I can't explain sort of where he came from and how he got to that point, but I just know that we're at a fresh start right now. Over the past year or so, we've been working really hard to try to work together to get that paid off. Obviously, it's his responsibility, but, from my perspective, I want to look at it starting, now moving forward instead of sort of thinking about what's been happening.
Okay, so is he promising to change his spending habits?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, over the past year, he's completely changed his spending habits, and the debt is quite old. I mean, it's probably from about 4 years ago. So it's just sort of growing because he hasn't been able to pay it off in a timely way.
I see. So if it was from about 4 years ago, does that mean he racked up debt taking you out to nice dinners early on in your relationship?
Potentially, I guess. Yeah.
I don't know. From the notes, it looks like he bought, toys.
Yeah.
That's how you described it.
Yep, totally. Primarily consumer debt. It's like DVDs, toys. He's like a super hardcore toy collector for a long time. And, he just shouldn't have been.
Here's the thing. When you have debt, I don't think that debt is the end of the world, but I've seen two types of people, who are committed to paying it off and people who just aren't. And so, I've seen people pay off $7,000 in 7 months' time, making, $50,000 in New York City. So if you do the math on that, trust me, that is impressive. That's like living on $150 a week in New York, eating peanut butter sandwiches. So if you really are committed to paying down debt, you can make that happen. And I would want to see that from him before you start investing too much of your own financial, you know, hopes or even your dollars. I don't even want to go there, really.
So, Lauren, that's the deal breaker, to see a very traditional, very conservative, just paying down the debt month by month. And that will help Vivian. Do you think it'll help you, Vivian?
I mean, absolutely. And I have no intention of getting mixed up financially with this person at this point. Absolutely not. But, you know, from, you know, what I'm looking for some advice around is, would the recommendation be for consolidation? I mean, how can I be a support system and make the right recommendations for this person without feeling like I'm being too invasive or getting too involved? And then also balancing the expectation of an undergraduate degree.
The best thing you can usually do is just come up with a plan and put as much of your budget towards paying down the debt as possible. There's a really good calculator online. There's a site called readyforzero.com, and I don't know the exact link, but they've got a great get-out-of-debt calculator. So you can put in all the information, the various cards, any loans, whatever, and they will come up with a plan for you. You run different scenarios. You know, if you pay X amount, how fast will you get out of debt? So those sorts of things, those are the steps you can help him, you know, discover and then let him feel empowered to really pay down the debt. Balance transfer cards, all that kind of thing, really only apply in very specific situations. So most often it's just like eating peanut butter until the debt is gone.
That's really great advice.
Vivian, I wish you very, very good peanut butter.
I appreciate it.
And good luck. I hope that gives you some clarity in moving forward with your finances and your relationship.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling in.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, Lauren, people can change, can't they?
Absolutely. I really believe they can. I do. I believe that. And I never think that someone's a lost cause financially. I just think we also need to be realistic and make sure that we're not enabling anyone.
Okay, let's take an email now. I have an email here from James in Fort Benning, Georgia, and it's about credit cards. We're going to switch it up. So James is 23. He just graduated last year, and he already makes about $48,000 a year after benefits. He has three credit cards, he says, paid in full every month, and he is carrying about $50,000 in student debt, but that's the only debt he has. And he says he has a credit score in the 740 range. Wow. Now, he keeps getting credit card offers, all with low initial rates, that then they pop up to delayed interest rates of 20%. I get a lot of those in my mailbox, too. So James's question is, with a credit score in the 700s as a young adult, why am I being courted by lenders with such high interest rates? Is my credit score not very high after all?
I love this question. I really do, because I think there's something that everyone who's listening can do as a result of this question. I hate those credit card offers, right? They send them to us and you hate to throw them away because you worry that someone's going to find it and someone will open a credit card in your name or something.
Oh, should we shred them?
Oops. It wasn't even going to be the tip, but yeah, actually, better to shred them. But I mean, actually, I have an even better idea than bothering to shred them, and that would be to actually opt out of receiving these in the first place. So to be honest, I don't really know the answer to this question. I'm not sure. I think that's just a marketing thing from the credit card
company.
Yeah,
they're just blanket mailings, right?
Right. I mean, I'm sure there's some sort of algorithm to it. But more importantly, I think that we all need to opt out of receiving these letters. So there's actually a website you can go to. It's called optoutprescreen.com.
One of my favorite sites. Yeah, oh. You can make this a favorite on your tab screen. Yeah.
Absolutely. And so with a credit score like what he has, that's a great credit score. So he doesn't need to worry. It's going to go up over time as he pays down the student loans and as he builds credit history. As he gets older, it'll go up and continues to make on-time payments. But in the meantime, opt out of receiving those mailings in the first place. So optoutprescreen.com. Or another one that I really love is Paper Karma, which is an app.
Huh.
And
okay.
Same thing, you can unsubscribe from mailings like those because really there's no – I mean, here's the thing. Any mailing that you're getting, that's not your credit card. You don't want to open a credit card because someone sent you an advertisement in the mail. What you want to do if you're opening a credit card is go online and research the options available to you and choose the best card that fits your needs.
PaperKarma.com. I'm writing that down.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Okay, that is really great news. There you go. Now you know, James, and I hope that helped you out. Lauren, we have to take a break now, and then we'll be back with more questions and more answers from you. I hope. Can you stick around?
I'd love to. Thanks.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Barbara Bogave, and we're taking your calls about money issues. Personal finance expert Lauren Lyons Cole is here in the studio with me. Lauren, you ready for our next taker?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. Well, it's Pennsylvania all the way today, but Andrea is calling us from Pittsburgh. Hi, Andrea.
Hello. Thank you.
Andrea, what do you do for a living in Pittsburgh, and what's your favorite sandwich place? Pepe's, DeLuca's, or Permanente Brothers?
Permanente Brothers is up there on the list.
Now we know you have an appetite. So what do you do?
I am a PhD student in epidemiology at the University of Pittsburgh and a stay-at-home mom.
Oh, great. Well, what's your money question?
I am recently a single mom, and I had planned on being a stay-at-home mom until my daughter is in preschool. But circumstances have recently changed, and in case I need extra money, my main question is, should I consider taking out student loans and using some of that to pay tuition and the rest for living expenses, or should I cash in my Roth IRA?
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions to get a bigger picture of your finances. You're a PhD student, so what are you living on right now? Grants?
I'm living on savings right now.
Oh, and what are your savings?
Right now, I have a little over $13,000 in savings.
Uh-huh, and what are your monthly expenses?
My monthly expenses are about $1,400 per month.
Lauren, I'm writing this down. I hope you're writing this down. And you're in the midst of a divorce. You said you're soon to become a single mother. Do you have any idea what kind of child or spousal support you'll be awarded?
I won't know for a couple of months.
Okay. And any debt?
I have no debt.
I hear a lovely chirping child there. And so you're using the stay-at-home mother term pretty loosely because you want to have a part-time job and finish your PhD, but spend as much time as possible with that adorable little chirping one-year-old there?
Precisely.
Okay. Okay. And why, just to put a finer point on it, you call this fulfilling your dream of being a stay-at-home mom. Tell us, what is that dream?
Well, just being there to raise her and watch her develop and go through all of the rapid changes that she goes through every couple of days. She looks different. So being there for that process is participating in it and nurturing it. That's my dream.
I have two kids. I totally relate to that. I mean, that is just time you'll never have again. So, okay, Lauren, let you loose.
Yeah, you know, I'm just listening to everything you're saying, Andrea, and I think you're painting such a good picture. I feel like I've gone in like three different directions as you've been talking, the type of advice that I wanted to give you. But, you know, the biggest thing that I'm picking up on is that this is a big time of transition for you. So when it comes to transition, something that I've found that is really helpful for people is having a nice sense of financial security, a nice little cushion that you can look at and know, you know what, things are a little rocky right now, but in the long run, I'm going to be okay. And as I'm listening to you, and I know you're working towards your PhD, but of course you have your daughter and you want to focus on her, I really don't think that tapping into your Roth IRA is a good decision. So, as you know, it's possible. Any contributions that you've made to a Roth IRA, you can withdraw. There's no penalty. There's no taxes. That's just on the contributions that you've made. So it's possible. But the fact that you have no student loan debt, you have no other debt. I mean, if you really are going to be focused on your PhD, if you can get a part-time job, maybe you'll get some other support. I think that student loans are going to be the best path for you, which is not exactly what I was thinking at first. But the one thing with student loans, too, is we know it's going to be a fixed rate. It's going to be 6.2%. We know what to expect. With taking money out of your Roth IRA, you're missing out on investment returns, which could also be investment losses. So, you know, it's a kind of a gamble. It could end up being fine. It could end up being you could end up missing out on quite a bit of growth in your retirement account. So I think the student loans with the 6.2 fixed percent rate, I think if you have to do something, that would be a better decision.
And you're studying epidemiology, right? So when you do get your PhD, do you have a good chance of getting a decent paying job and you'll be able to pay down those student loans?
Yes.
So, Lauren, can Andrea afford her dream?
I think so. I really do. And I wish you all the best because I think it's going to be a good year. I just have that sense for you.
Thank you. Does Lauren believe that it could go for possibly 2 years? Right now she's one, and I was hoping to make it until she's three. Does that change the answer at all?
You know, here's the rule of thumb with student loans. Don't take out more than your first year salary when you graduate. So if you know what salary you can expect, just keep that as your limit when it comes to student loans. You should be able to afford that, especially if you feel like, you know, if you're going to have a PhD, hopefully you'll be employable and you should be able to manage those payments in the long run while still keeping your retirement savings, which will continue to grow and just be a source of comfort, I think.
Okay.
There you go. Thanks so much for calling in, Andrea.
Thank you. Thank you so
Best
much.
Of luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Oh, it's so when people want that to be home with their children as much as possible, and almost every parent wants that. It's so hard to figure out if you can afford it.
It is. I get it.
Lauren, that'll do it for this letters portion of our show. Personal finance expert Lauren Lyons Cole. It was so great having you here. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Barbara. It's great to be here.
Just ahead, debt consolidation, ads touted as the solution to all your money woes. But before you even consider it, there are some things you should know.
Ideally, you want to be able to pay off your debt in no more than 3, 4, or 5 years. If it's going to take you longer than that, you're probably a better candidate for something like credit counseling. You may even need to look at something like bankruptcy.
That and more from Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Barbara Bogave. This week, Marketplace launched a year-long look at education and technology. We're calling it Learning Curve. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is the lead reporter on the project. Here she is. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, Barbara.
Well, that is such a huge topic. What do you have in store for us?
You know, we are trying to tackle it from all sorts of angles. So we started this week really looking at the history of education technology. You know, one thing that struck me in this reporting is that public radio actually has roots in educational technology. It was once in schools as a broadcast medium.
Oh, I did not know
so
that.
So if you think about WBEZ.
The University of the Air.
Yes.
Right?
Schools of the Air. So WBEZ in Chicago, the BE is for Board of Ed. WABE in Atlanta, the ABE is Atlanta Board of Education. WBOE in Cleveland is off the air now, but it was also Board of Ed. So all of these radio stations, many radio stations that are public radio stations today, actually got, or in their early days, were in schools doing broadcasts to kids.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, it's been fascinating.
And I'm thinking also, as far as the personal finance angle goes, so much of this debate about the role of technology in education comes down to money and the issues of economic inequality, which are so central to education now. So how will you be tackling that?
Yeah, again, I think we're taking a sort of broad view and looking at this lots of ways. I mean, we are just starting out on this project, but I do think that this comes up in different ways in classrooms. We heard from a listener who said that at his kid's school, all the kids in the school use their smartphones to sort of look things up in class. And he said, my kid doesn't have a smartphone. Now, I don't know if this is because of money or ideological reasons.
For whatever reason, how that kid feels.
Right. And he says, my kid feels really left out. And I think that as technology becomes more and more the norm in classrooms and out of classrooms, when teachers require tech, kids to go home and watch a video online, this issue of inequality and sort of the finances of it all become a big deal.
And it becomes very personal. I have two kids, mm-hmm. as you know, and I invested in probably more expensive computers earlier on than I should have for them because I think of it as an investment in their future and especially in a data-driven economy.
Right.
And they were those kinds of kids. And that belief also influences, I think, how much time we let our kids sit in front of screens.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I have an 18-month-old, and so there are the rules by the powers that be right now are no screen time under two. So it's an easy decision for me to make because I just say no screens until two. But once we get to two, I have no idea how to think about screen time. How valuable is it so he's not the Luddite in the kindergarten full of iPad experts? I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know.
You know, getting back to this idea of public radio and its roots in education, when my kids were little, and this goes back 20 years, I did a story about computers in preschools.
Wow.
It was called Nap Time, Snack Time, Computer Time. Snappy.
So snappy. I like it a lot. I might borrow it.
But anyway, the question was, do computers help kids learn? And the answer was, we don't really know, or we didn't know back then. And it depends what you do with the computers. So are the questions different now, or the answers?
I think the questions are still very similar, I think. And the discussion is similar. There are lots of people out there right now who are saying, look, technology can be really valuable for kids and the way they learn, as long as we think of it as the sort of tool to get them to sort of bigger ideas instead of just making them become sort of tools of the computer, if that makes sense. We don't want them just to sit there and do math worksheets on the computer. We want them actually to sort of think more broadly and use the technology to help them sort of have a bigger worldview. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. But it's hard to parse that with the money angle also.
Again,
because
absolutely.
Computers in schools, politicians are always happy to tout that. It looks good.
It looks good. And I think I was talking to a professor at USC for one of the stories I worked on, and she's looked at really big school districts, often with many low-income kids. And she says what she sees right now is that low-income kids are often getting sort of less useful technology. That right now, the really valuable technology is going to high-income schools, schools that can afford that great technology. And some of the technology that's maybe, we're not sure about.
Or that, even cast-offs.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's going to schools that don't have a lot of money.
All of those questions and many answers, I'm sure. I'm looking forward to the series. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Marketplace's Adrienne Hill. And you can find out more about Marketplace's year-long look into technology in education. Just go to marketplace.org and look for the words learning curve. And that'll get you more info and the Tumblr and Twitter feed links. Thanks again.
Thanks.
Shopping. You are doing it wrong. But it's not your fault. You're caught in a classic catch-22. You need to work all week in order to have money to spend on the weekend. But if you wait until Saturday to step foot in a store, you've already missed the bargains. So what's a savvy spender to do? We pose the question today to Katie Hill. She's the consumer reporter for MarketWatch. And thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So what with so many people working flex time and weekends and freelancing and telecommuting, how many Americans still shop primarily on the weekends and how much are they spending then?
Most of them. So Fridays and Saturdays, people tend to spend about 40% more than they do on Mondays and Tuesdays, which are the days that people shop the least. So, of course, it makes sense. We all work jobs. We don't have time to shop during the week sometimes. But yeah, most people are doing their shopping on Fridays and Saturdays. When really the reality is most of the deals are kind of midweek on a lot of different kinds of things.
Well, right. How do prices for consumer goods on the weekends compare to what the same things cost during the week?
So sometimes the prices are the same, but it's an inventory issue. So take groceries, for example. Most people do their grocery shopping on Saturday. It's way above what they do during the week. But here's the thing. So most grocery stores release those circulars and their deals around Tuesdays or Wednesdays. They also happen to get shipments of groceries, of all the new stuff, right around then. Now, this isn't a perfect science, but it's pretty close. So Wednesday is when they tend to release the deals. Plus, they tend to get shipments in earlier in the week. So if you want the best deal, with the most inventory, you're often best off shopping for groceries on Wednesday. But of course, people feel like they don't have time, so they do it on a Saturday.
Well, and that doesn't even count for just good deals. You're getting the freshest merchandise too on Wednesdays, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in general, and of course, this is sort of something you need to play around with at your own grocery store. Like, oh, okay, you can sort of see what's happening, even ask people. But yeah, it tends to be Wednesday freshest produce and when they're releasing those deals. So you can combine that to really get the best stuff at the best price.
Well, are there secret best days of the week for pretty much
everything. And a friend of mine just made fun of me for shopping at some big discount
big
store on a Friday. Right. She said, don't you know it's Tuesdays there?
I mean, there are for a lot of things. So clothing, for example, this tends to be best on a Wednesday or a Thursday because a lot of these big clothing retailers release sales, which they're hoping to put, you know, they're hoping people will go shopping on like, you know, Friday or Saturday, actually. So they release these deals on Wednesday or Thursday kind of in preparation for the weekend. But there's so many avid couponers that are like, oh, deals released. I'm getting this right now, that by the time Saturday has rolled around, the inventory is much more picked through. So you're much better off really taking that coupon, that deal that's being released on a Wednesday, Thursday. That's when they tend to do it, and going for it right away if you can.
Well, you are making shopping sound so much like a hunt, a sport, a competitive
That's how
sport.
I like it.
Well, okay. So I hardly ever go out to eat on Saturday nights because it's just too crowded.
It's crazy.
And
yeah.
loud. It's so loud.
Crazy. Yeah.
But what night should I be eating out to get a better deal? Taco Tuesdays?
Yeah, Tuesday tends to be the sweet spot for restaurants because it's notoriously the slowest time for the restaurant industry. So here's what they do. You'll see a lot of things like half-price bottle of wine, free appetizer. Sometimes those big chains will do kids eat free. That tends to be on a Tuesday. So if you can switch date night or whatever it is from Saturday night, you know, to Tuesday night. So go out on a Tuesday, stay home and cook on a Saturday. You avoid the crowds and you tend to get better deals because they're really just trying to get consumers into the restaurant, trying to pull you in with deals. And so they will unleash a lot of them on Tuesdays.
Well, probably our Marketplace Money listeners are motivated, definitely, by a lot of this information, and thank you for it. But you can't always change your life that much. Well, what have you done to change your habits in order to save some money?
That is an interesting question. So, yeah, no, and I agree. It's very hard to do your shopping during the week. I mean, that's just not a reality.
It's a drag.
But look, yeah, it is. You're just like, oh, I'm exhausted. But it's kind of worth it. So, for instance, clothing shopping, you can get a lot of those same deals that you can get in store on Wednesdays and Thursdays online. So if you have a lunch break or something and you're seeing a great deal, pop online. That's one way to do it. Yeah, I mean, and it's just if you can carve out an hour or two right after work just to get some errands done. But I know it's really hard for people. So if you, even if you just change one time, like if you can just squeeze in that grocery shopping one week, and then if you're going to get clothes shopping, do that next week, and just one little piece by piece at a time, that might be the easiest thing. But I do know it's really hard for people. When you're working, you're tired.
No, I guess you can build new habits too, right?
Right.
But on the converse of that, is there any benefit to sticking with tradition and shopping on the weekend?
Convenience is really the big thing because that's when you have the day off. But I mean, occasionally, so it looks from the data that I looked at, like sometimes accessories and books tend to be kind of better deals on weekends. Sometimes you get pretty good deals on appliances on Sundays. So there's some deals to be had on the weekends, but it's, you know, it tends to be less. It tends to be the middle of the week when you're seeing deals on everything from entertainment to restaurants to clothes, because that's when businesses are slowest and kind of unleashing that in some ways. So, you know, kind of depends.
You said books. I like to think of people going out to buy books still.
I know. Me too. Me too.
Katie Hill, consumer reporter for MarketWatch. Thanks so much for this. Nice talking with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, every little bit of bargain hunting helps, right? Because overspending and getting into debt, not a happy place to be. We've all seen the late-night TV ads, a frantic man on a cell phone, a woman wringing her hands over a calculator and a pile of bills, and the tagline, "Are you drowning in debt? We can consolidate what you owe into one low monthly payment." Debt consolidation. It's so often touted as a way to solve all your financial problems, and for free. So how much of it is legit? Jerry Detweiler is Director of Consumer Education for Credit.com. It's nice to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Okay, first, this idea of a debt-free solution to overwhelming debt. We all know there's no free lunch, so what's the catch?
Well, there's a lot of confusion about debt consolidation because a lot of those ads that you see are not actually companies that will consolidate your debt, but they will help you get out of debt. They're credit counseling agencies, and they will work with your creditors to get you on one monthly payment, lower your interest rate, and lower your payments. But they aren't actually paying off your debt like a true consolidation loan would do.
And a true consolidation loan, how do you know if that's the way you should go?
A consolidation loan can be a great way to save money and get out of debt faster. And the main reason that is that it typically is a fixed monthly payment for a fixed period of time. So, you know, with your credit card, you can pay the minimum payment, and before you know it, the debt is stretched out for a long time. With a consolidation loan, you know, okay, in 3 years, 4 years, or 5 years, this loan will be paid off. A few years ago, if you wanted a debt consolidation loan, you'd go to your bank or credit union. They'd hand you a credit card application or maybe a application for a home equity loan. But that industry has changed dramatically in the past few years thanks to the P2P or peer-to-peer lenders, which are the companies that basically take money from investors like you and me and lend it to other people who need to consolidate their debt.
And how does that fall out for the consumer? What are the pros and cons?
For the consumer, it can be a great way to save money because the interest rate is typically much lower. I still think consumers need to be cautious, though, because if you're really in a cash flow situation where it's tough to make your payments, then what happens is you consolidate and then something happens, and pretty soon those credit cards that were just paid off are there to pick up the difference, and now you have two debts, not just one.
So there are risks. So how do you know if you should take this route? Is there a rule of thumb you can use for who's a good candidate for debt consolidation? And what kind of debt can best be bundled?
Debt consolidation is usually good for unsecured debts, typically credit cards, which often carry higher interest rates. It's much trickier when you look at things like student loans, where there are a whole different set of rules that apply. If you are thinking about debt consolidation, I think there's two main things you need to ask yourself. One is, do I have a handle on my spending? So do I have a way to figure out whether I can actually work my way out of debt? If you're not sure about that, you might want to call one of those companies that's a credit counseling agency and get some free budgeting advice from them. The other thing you really want to look at before you consolidate is what your payment will be and how long it will take you to get out of debt. Ideally, you want to be able to pay off your debt in no more than 3, 4, or 5 years. If it's going to take you longer than that, then again, you're probably a better candidate for something like credit counseling. You may even need to look at something like bankruptcy.
So you wouldn't recommend, for instance, student loans, consolidating them with other debts?
The big risk with consolidating student loans is that you may lose some of the protections you have right now with federal student loans. So those protections include graduated repayment, forbearance, deferment. If you consolidate a federal student loan with a private student loan, for example, you lose those protections. It's not to say that consolidating student loans is not a good idea, but if you're going to do that, make sure you're going directly to the Department of Education, getting information there, and be very leery about third-party companies marketing you student loan consolidation because it can be fraught with all kinds of perils.
So it is a field, though, loaded with scams. How do you avoid them?
You have to be very, very, very careful about applying for a consolidation loan online. That's not to say there aren't reputable places that you can do this, but there are sites out there that look very professional, very attractive, and they typically promise money quickly with very little in terms of credit standards. And what they're doing is they are gathering your personal information, and then they turn around and sell that personal information to scammers. So even if you don't get a loan from them, there's a good chance that in a year or two, you're going to start hearing from debt collectors who are telling you that they're going to have you arrested or sue you in court for paying this debt, whether or not you took out the debt. So it's very, very risky. Make sure that you're dealing with a reputable company that's been around for a long time and that the site is secure.
Does debt consolidation inevitably affect your credit score?
You can actually improve your credit score with a debt consolidation loan, and here's why. One of the big factors in your credit score is how close your balances on your credit cards are to your credit limits. The closer you get to your credit limits, the more it affects your credit score in a negative way. A debt consolidation loan, however, is typically an installment loan. That means there's a fixed, you know, monthly payment, fixed repayment period. It's treated differently by credit scoring models. So if you shifted a credit card that has a high balance over to an installment loan, you may actually see a boost in your credit score. Now, that's not to say that just moving around your balances is the best strategy, because the best strategy for your credit and your financial health is to pay off your debt. But you could see a boost in the short term, which in turn could get you some really attractive offers if you do need to borrow, say, to get a car, replace the car that's broken down or something else.
Huh. And can it adversely affect your credit score?
Typically, a debt consolidation loan won't hurt your credit score as long as you make the monthly payments on time. Now, overall, having a lot of debt presents other risks because then you're at risk of perhaps missing a payment. And if you miss a payment, your credit score can drop dramatically in just 1 month. But overall, most consolidation loans, if they're treated as installment loans on your credit report, will be usually a plus rather than a minus.
Jerry Detweiler, Director of Consumer Education for Credit.com. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, thank you.
And that'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Marketplace Money is produced by Candace Manriquez and Caitlin Funaro. Our senior producer is Dan Simatovich. Robbie Carmen is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. And remember, always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Next time, David Lazarus will step in again to host here on Marketplace Money. I'm Barbara Bogave. I've really enjoyed talking money with you these past few weeks. Thanks for listening. This is APM.